When I first read 1 Timothy 5, verses 21 through 25, I found a disconnected collection of random thoughts. Things just didn't seem to make sense together. They didn't work together. But the more I studied, the more I came to see that this section is a list of pitfalls that we could encounter when making judgments, when judging. Well, some are going to ask, what does it have to do with me? I'm not a judge. I'm not in a position of authority. Well, Jesus said that his apostles would sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Rulership and judgment are connected. And so the saints who receive that crown at the resurrection will also be responsible for judging. But of course, we make decisions related to people every day. We make judgments. We're looking at the way things are going about, what people are doing, and saying, is that an appropriate thing to be doing? And then we ask, should I join this activity? We're judging ourselves as well. So learning some of the pitfalls in judgment can certainly help us. So today let's discuss the four pitfalls of judgment found in these verses. Let's go to 1 Timothy 5, and we'll read 21 through 25. And see if you can pick out the pitfalls that I found here. 1 Timothy 5, 21 through 25. I charge you before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels that you observe these things without prejudice, doing nothing with partiality. Do not lay hands on anyone hastily, nor share in other people's sins. Keep yourself pure. No longer drink only water, but use a little wine for your stomach's sake and your frequent infirmities. Some men's sins are clearly evident, preceding them to judgment, but those of some men follow later. Likewise, the good works of some are clearly evident, and those that are otherwise cannot be hidden. What did you find in there? Did you find some pitfalls? Did you find a random collection of ideas jumbled together? So first, let's make some observations about the text. In verse 21, he says, charge, I charge you. And that word is used 15 times in the New Testament. It's translated as charge 3 times, but the other ones, it's translated witness once or testify. Testify 11 times. In verse 19, Paul references the principle of having 2 or 3 witnesses to testify and establish something. And so Paul here invokes 3 witnesses to underscore the seriousness of his instruction. He says, I charge you before God and the Lord Jesus Christ and the elect angels. 3 witnesses called for this testification. Paul also uses, in verse 21, he says, these things. He uses that 8 times in this letter. That's a single word. It's usually translated this, but in this letter it's these things, because it's the plural. And it can refer to people, or to objects, or to just about anything else. So, we should expect to find the subject of these things referenced close by, such as verses 19 and 20, where he's talking about receiving accusations and rebuking when necessary. Again, in verse 21, the Greek words prejudice and partiality are both hapax legomena. That fancy word means they're used only once. These are the only 2 places, or the only 1 place, where these 2 words are used in the entire Bible. And so we need to do a little bit of digging to find out what they mean. Now, the word partiality is in the English version of the Bible 9 more times, but it comes from different words, not from the same one translated partiality here. In verses 21 and 22, we find two things to avoid in each verse. In verse 21, he says to avoid prejudice and partiality. In verse 22, we're told to avoid laying hands hastily and sharing other people's sins. Verse 24 picks up the theme of sin from verse 22. We see that sin is referenced in both sections. And in verses 24 and 25, we find parallel thoughts. In verse 24, sins are clearly evident, while in 25, good works are clearly evident. And in both cases, what was not originally clearly evident will come to light at some point. And then verse 23 seems to be a thought out of left field. What does this have to do with anything? And I was not alone in wondering why this is here. Barnes' notes on the whole Bible says, "There has been much difficulty felt in regard to the connection which this advice has with what precedes and what follows. Many have considered the difficulty to be so great that they have supposed this verse has been displaced and that it should be introduced in some other connection. Maybe this verse belongs somewhere else." I've seen several suggestions on why this verse is placed here in the letter. Some suppose it may be an addition in the margin, that as Paul was going over and reviewing the letter, he had a thought and jotted in the margin, and then in later copying, that marginal note ended up in the main text. I've seen the suggestion that Paul did not want Timothy to misunderstand his comment about keep yourself pure. So when Timothy read keep yourself pure, perhaps he supposed that Paul meant don't drink any alcohol whatsoever, avoid it at all costs. Now, the wording indicates that Timothy was already avoiding alcohol. Either he was drinking only water and Paul recommended elsewise, so I'm not sure that theory holds water, if you'll pardon the pun. The view that makes the most sense to me is that keep yourself pure jogged Paul's memory, that he was thinking about Timothy and his frequent infirmities, and that reference to keep yourself pure sort of reminded him of that, and so Paul offered a suggestion on how perhaps to relieve his symptoms. Barclay's Daily Bible Study says, "This sentence shows the real intimacy of these letters. Amidst the affairs of the church and the problems of administration, Paul finds time to slip in a little bit of loving advice to Timothy about his help." And I think that seems to make the most sense. So, let me give you three observations. Number one, Paul is not telling Timothy that he can overindulge, that he can consume a whole lot of alcohol. He says to use a little wine. In 1 Timothy 3:8, where he's talking about ordaining people to various positions in the church, he's already said that we should not ordain those who are given too much wine. Now, some suggest that Paul wasn't talking about alcohol, he was talking about unfermented grape juice. But I think that reference, the same not given to much wine, which is the same word, seems to argue against that. Why would you be concerned that somebody's drinking a lot of grape juice and not ordaining them to the ministry because of that? So this definitely seems to be talking about wine. But, as we've said, Paul does not say you can overindulge. And the third item, Paul is not commenting on social drinking, going out and having a beer with the guys or stopping into the wine bar with the girls. Certainly, we may argue that that's okay, but this verse cannot be used in support of that. He's talking about using wine medicinally as an aid to the stomach or to various other parts of his health. Verse 22 is usually seen as a recommendation to be cautious when ordaining men to office, and that is certainly sound advice. Again, back in 1 Timothy 3, verse 6, Paul talks about avoiding ordaining novices, somebody who is new. We need to allow time for the fruits to develop. Laying hands on, of course, suggests ordination because ordinations are conducted that way, and as far as we know, they have been conducted that way. When we look back at Acts 6, when the first deacons were being selected for office, Luke writes, "And they chose seven men whom they set before the apostles, and when they had prayed, they laid hands on them." And that certainly seems to be the idea of ordaining them into the position of a deacon by the anointing, the laying on of hands. So if this section describes ordination, what did Paul mean by "nor share in other people's sins"? How is that related? Expositor's Bible commentary says, "If Timothy ordained an elder, he thereby became in a measure a surety for this person's character, and thus was implicated in any sins the man might commit." That seems to then be a heavy responsibility on ordaining somebody to office to be careful, because if that person sins, then the person who ordained them is responsible. As I said, that's a heavy responsibility. Kaufman's commentaries on the Bible comes to the same conclusion. They say this warns that the person responsible for anointing elders who prove unfaithful is, in a sense, partaker of their sins, unless due deliberation, investigation, and testing preceded such unfortunate appointment. Now, the question that I have is there a statute of limitations? Is there some limited warranty on this? You know, if somebody is ordained, if they don't sin within 5 years, then I'm off the hook. It's, you know, after that, it's not my responsibility. So I have some struggles with that particular interpretation. Unfortunately, we have no other examples for Paul to help determine what he meant by laying on of hands. The phrase "lay the hands on" is used 21 times in the New Testament. 19 of those are in the Gospels and Acts. After that, there's this one use and one in Revelation where the angel puts his hand on and says, "Don't worry." Only one of those 21 uses relates to ordination, and that's the one that we just looked at in Acts 6. The others describe laying hands on for healing, laying hands on for blessing, such as the blessing of the little children, or in connection with baptism. So, I think Paul is describing something other than ordination in this section. The context of these verses is dealing with accusations against elders. Let's go back to verse 19. Timothy receives an accusation against an elder, and so he investigates to see if there are other witnesses who can verify the accusation, who can confirm that. Verse 20, once confirmed, the offense must be rebuked in the presence of all. To me, I see that as a very challenging thing for Timothy to do. He's dealing with friends. He's dealing with co-workers, members of the church that he's worked with and socialized with, and now he'd need to rebuke them. I can see that being somewhat challenging. And so in verse 21, these things, the investigation, the judgment, and any possible reprimand, should be done without prejudice, without partiality, and those are both terms related to judgment. Verse 22, Timothy then should not be hasty in his actions. I think Paul means to not be hasty in his reprimand or other remedial action that needs to be taken with these elders. If that is true, then the "nor share" comment means that Timothy should not do the opposite of being hasty. Don't delay action. and thereby allow sin to continue on his watch. And then in verses 24 and 25, the reason to avoid prejudice, to avoid partiality, to avoid hastiness and inaction in judgment, is because what we think we know may turn out to be quite different upon further investigation. And I'm not the first one to reach this conclusion. In the commentary Contending for the Faith, they explain this. For the words, lay hands suddenly on no man, that's the Authorized Version's translation. They say this phrase implies the seizing of another and removing him from his place. Even though this action is not to be performed literally, we don't simply grab somebody and take him out, the context demands that removal from office is being considered. Paul commands Timothy to show no partiality, even in the case of an elder, and warns him to give due consideration to the matter and to conduct a thorough investigation before any action is warranted. Moving on to the section, neither be partakers of other men's sins. They say, if an elder has so sinned as to demand that he be removed from office, he must be removed. An evangelist who refuses to see that steps are taken to remove him becomes guilty of partaking of the sins of the elder. This situation would, in modern terms, be likened to a cover-up. And I think we've seen that in various news stories over the years. Something that people knew about and didn't take care of has been covered up. And when it finally comes to light, it's a big deal. And those who allowed it to continue are just as guilty in some cases, in many cases, as those who perpetrated the actions. They could have stopped it, but they didn't. And so let's move on to the four pitfalls that we found in this text. Pitfall number one, prejudice. As we said, this word appears only once in the Bible. It's composed of two other words, which are before and decide. To decide beforehand, an alternate translation is to prejudge, to reach a conclusion before sufficient time has been given to investigation, to consideration. Now, Timothy might be tempted to prejudge based on the expected consequences of his actions. Perhaps if he takes the action he's considering or reaching the conclusion that seems to be pointing to, that might result in the loss of respect or standing for the church. And I think we've seen that in several church scandals over the years in various denominations around the world. People are afraid that if the news of this particular activity comes to light, that people are going to disrespect the church, and so they cover it up. They reach a conclusion beforehand. Well, I can't reach that conclusion because of these consequences, therefore, I'll reach the other one. Perhaps Timothy might be tempted because he'd need to find replacements to do the work of the people he's removed from office. And that would be difficult and challenging, so we'll just prejudge. He might be tempted because his own involvement could be questioned. How much did Timothy know and when did he know it? And so to avoid that, we preordain a conclusion. Perhaps he thinks he knows. He's already reached a conclusion because these things are clearly evident. Well, it's obvious. No time for reflection is necessary. Let's go to Proverbs 18 and verse 13. Proverbs 18 and verse 13. Proverbs of Solomon. Now, Solomon should know something about wisdom and something about judgment. Let's see what he has to say here. Proverbs 18 and verse 13. He who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. don't answer a matter, or sometimes it's translated a word, before we hear it. This is true in personal relationships. Someone comes and asks a question. They start into a question, and we answer it before they've even asked the question because we think we know what they're going to say. When it deals with matters of judgment or other things, if we reach a conclusion before we've heard the arguments, before we've heard the discussion, the facts, etc., it's folly. It's shame, Solomon says. Let's go down to verse 17. Here's part of the reason why it's shame and folly. In verse 17, he says, the first one to plead his cause seems right. And I know I've experienced that as a parent many times. Kid one comes and says, this is what happened. He hit me. He did this. Or, you know, she took my stuff. And based on those facts, it's clear. Reprimand is in order. The first one to plead his cause seems right, until his neighbor comes and examines him. And then we start getting the other side of the story. We start finding out more information. Because people are likely to present the story when they present it to shine the best light on themselves, to gloss over some of the negative things, some of the reasons that their active participation should be ignored. We're just looking at the actions of the other one. And so when we hear the other side of the story, things take on a different light. Are we quick to reach a judgment? Do we skip over the facts because, well, it's clearly evident. There's no need to take time to investigate or to look. James 1:19 talks about being swift to hear and slow to speak. I found that information personally helpful because I'm often very quick to speak. In business meetings and other in things like that, people have started to make comments, and I know where they're going, and I'm going to, well, come to find out I didn't know where they were going. I hadn't heard the whole story. And so if I take time to listen to the whole question, to ask my own questions about my understanding of what they have said, I often come to a much different picture. You heard the old joke, we have two ears but only one mouth, and we're supposed to use them in that proportion. Listen twice as much as we hear. We have to get past what we think is clearly evident and get on to that part of what follows later. Pitfall number two is partiality. Again, this word appears only once in the Bible, and it's composed of two words that are toward and lean. To lean toward something. Some translations have the word favoritism. Favoritism here. Timothy might be tempted to play favorites because of his personal relationships with specific people. Again, he's worked with these people. He's gone out on visiting trips with them. They've gone through prisons or various other trials and scourgings. That's developed a bond. Or people have such a good reputation that, of course, whatever's accused can't possibly be true. Let's go back to Leviticus 19. Leviticus 19, we'll look at 35 and 36. God talked about this topic way back when Israel was beginning to form a nation. They were coming out of Egypt and beginning the process of nation building, if you will, and judgment factors heavily into that. Leviticus 19, 35. He says, you shall do no injustice in judgment. in measurement of length, weight, or volume. You shall have honest scales, honest weights, an honest ephah, and an honest hin, which is a measurement. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. They were to have no injustice in any of these things. Now, we can understand that readily when it comes to weights and measures and volumes. An ancient practice, and I have to suppose it's still around these days, is to have two different sets of weights in the bag. One heavy when you're buying. So you put that heavy weight on, which means you get a little more than what you paid for when you're buying. And that other set is a little light, and we use that when selling. And so I sell a little less than what they've paid for, and by that dishonesty, attempt to come out ahead. And just like when putting the thumb on the scale to change that measurement is wrong, putting a thumb on the scales of justice is contrary to the law and the will of God. Let's go forward to Deuteronomy 1. We'll look at verse 16. Deuteronomy 1, 16, 17. There were too many disputes in this new nation for Moses to hear all of them himself. And so, wise men, leaders of their community, were chosen to be judges. And so Moses says here, "Then I commanded your judges at that time, saying, hear the cases between your brethren, and judge righteously between a man and his brother, or the stranger who is with him. You shall not show partiality in judgment. You shall hear the small as well as the great. You shall not be afraid of any man's presence, for the judgment is God's." How were they to judge righteously? That word to show partiality is literally to respect persons or to recognize faces. To recognize faces. Sometimes the rich and the powerful are recognized. Perhaps it's to gain favor. The judge wants to gain favor, perhaps for personal benefit later. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. Or perhaps fear of retribution. If I reach this conclusion, this person has what it takes to destroy me. And so the scales are tipped in favor of the rich or powerful. Sometimes the poor or underprivileged are recognized to appear virtuous or to correct past injustices. The scales are tipped in favor of the poor. Their faces are recognized. Sometimes a brother, as opposed to a foreigner or a stranger, is recognized. The scales are tipped because I recognize that face. That's something that's been a big controversy in our country recently. All of those things are leaning towards a conclusion, leaning towards one side or the other, rather than judging righteously. And so we have to ask, do we tip the scales in our own favor? Do we tip the scales in favor of our friends? Perhaps assume that they are innocent until proven guilty, while we look at others and assume that they're guilty until proven innocent. Let's look at pitfall number 3, hastiness. Hastiness. Now, whether Paul was saying to avoid rushing into ordaining people or to avoid rushing into judgment and punishment, he cautions against being hasty. Dictionary.com says haste is unnecessarily quick action, thoughtless, rash, or undue speed, moving quickly than we really should be. Timothy might be tempted to be hasty to get past all this unpleasantness. Put it behind us and let's just move on. Perhaps he might be tempted because he's busy with all the things he has to do, the visiting and the counselings and the preparing speeches and preaching and etc. to just get it done. Mark it off the checklist. Let's get on to some other things. But as we saw in verse 24, some sins show up later. They take time to discover. They take time to reveal. And so making decisions without all the facts opens up the door to injustice. Let's go forward to Proverbs 19 and verse 2. Proverbs 19 and verse 2. The New King James says, "Also, it's not good for a soul to be without knowledge, and he sins who hastens with his feet." The NIV translates it this way: "It is not good to have zeal without knowledge, nor to be hasty and miss the way." That word soul is sometimes translated desire, which is where the NIV gets zeal. It's not good to have zeal without knowledge. Being ready to go and ready to act is good, but without sufficient information, we miss the way. As I said, wanting to deal quickly with the problem is good, but knowing all the facts and giving time for them to develop is key. Do we rush to judgment? Do we rush to punish? Or even rush to excuse without our due diligence? The last one, pitfall 4, inaction. Hastiness is a problem, but the opposite, not taking action when action is warranted, can also be a problem. Timothy might be tempted to not act out of fear of taking the wrong action, and that's good. We don't want to do the wrong thing. But if that leads to doing nothing, that's a problem. Perhaps Timothy might fear making enemies amongst his friends. And so if I just leave it, maybe it'll all blow over. Perhaps it's avoidance, burying his head in the sand. Maybe it'll all just go away. Maybe it'll clear up on its own. And let's go forward a little more to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes 8, verses 11 and 12. Ecclesiastes 8:11, "Because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil." And we've seen that with all sorts of authorities. If something isn't enforced, people get the idea that they can do it. God is not punishing us immediately. God doesn't step in right this moment. Smith's Bible commentary says the following: "People begin to misinterpret the long-suffering of God. Because he doesn't immediately come down with the fist of judgment upon a man many times thinks he's getting away with evil, thinks that God is condoning what he has done. He says, 'I'm a prosperous cheat, so God is condoning my cheating.'" And people begin to misinterpret God's grace and God's long-suffering as God's approbation for their actions and for their lives. "Not so," he says, "God will judge." I've seen that so many times with the HOV lanes. At least when I lived in California, nobody moved in and out. If you did, the police would stop you and give you a hefty ticket. And here in the HOV lanes, we got barriers and whatever else, and people are hopping in back and forth. Because sentence is not executed speedily. I've seen that as a parent. And it's up to me to take action when action is necessary. And it's the same with any authority. If not corrected, problems continue. And so we need to ask, do we avoid taking action when action is needed? When we're with our friends, perhaps, and they're starting to do something that we look at and say, that's not right. Not going along with that is hard to do. Calling out our friends and saying, "No, I'm going to walk away from this. You shouldn't be doing that either." That's a very difficult thing to do. So let's review what we've found out today. The connection between these verses was not clearly evident when we started. But with a little time and effort, we begin to see some of these relationships. Sin and good works oftentimes take time to show up, take time to come to light. And so we need to avoid pitfalls of judgment, including prejudice, deciding before we've heard all the facts, partiality, tipping the scales one way or the other, hastiness, rushing ahead without evaluating properly, and inaction, allowing bad behavior to continue. And of course, on the positive side, a little wine could be good for our health.